for so very long, it's been...
Go on, George. Tell how it's gonna be.
But in the end, the commish only said...
We figured it 17 different ways. And every time we figured it, was no good. Because no matter how we figured it...
But no matter how you figure it out, I still don't get as much as anybody else.
Somebody don't like the way we figured it. So now, there's only one way to figure it. And that is every man for himself.
When Black Friday comes,
this is the end.
It's the end of the world.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Or is it now? As a new year hits, through it all, Beaver Nation moves ahead with resiliency and hope.
Sun's up. Mm-hmm. Looks okay. The world survives into another day.
And the way forward goes through, as it must, The Joe Beaver Show with John Warren and Mike Parker.
A number of times I heard these guys' voices over and over and over. Still can't find it.
Ah, can't find it? We can help.
This here is 1240.
1240?
It's always been 1240.
My client says it's 1240.
Yeah, plus 93.7 FM and streaming live at KEJOAM.com and on the KEJO app. It's The Joe Beaver Show.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Joe Beaver Show. Mike Parker, John Warren, a busy show today. Bill McShane will join us this hour, a little bit later in the hour. Jenny Kavnar, who is a play-by-play broadcaster on Fox Sports and the Pac-12 networks and a host and reporter for Sportsnet Rocky Mountain, AT&T Sportsnet Rocky Mountain, a host on Sirius XM, Major League Baseball Network Radio, one of the voices of the Colorado Rockies, and just called the Beavers game at CU Event Center in Boulder Saturday with Matt Muehlbach. It was the first time Matt said he'd ever worked with Jenny. Jenny said, yeah, I've never worked with Matt before. Looking forward to it. I don't know how the broadcast went. I was busy calling the game on the radio on the other side, so... But I liked her. I introduced myself to her because we had already connected with her to be on the show. I said, hey, you're going to be on our show next week. I just want to introduce myself to you. And she immediately, not that she was trying to, how can I ingratiate myself with the voice of the Beavers? Now, I mean, that wasn't like, it was kind of the opposite, if that makes any sense. Yeah. But when we started talking about her background in baseball and baseball broadcasting and how her first job was with the San Diego Padres, that led to just talking about Dick Enberg, Ted Leitner, and we got around to Vin Scully. And she said that she's not met anyone better than him, and they named their son Vincent.
That's real cool.
In honor of Vinny. So I knew, this is a cool soul, a good soul. Mm-hmm. And she will join us at 12:05. At 12:30... OSU Hall of Famer, Final Four, team member, player, averaged 21 points per game the year after Mel Counts, who, by the way, is on our guest request list. We've heard from the great Bill Walton, who just, in a very eloquent text, and I might even share the text mm-hmm. with you about his unavailability for us this week, just because it's Waltonese. It's beautiful, and just his, I can't do the show. It's different. His reply to he can't do the show this week is in itself a contribution to the show, and I'll share that text with you in a moment. But Jim Jarvis will join us at 12:30 to talk about playing for Slats, coaching with Ralph, with Paul. The heritage of Oregon State basketball is so rich, John. When I think about and read about and go back and research and dig into our glorious history with the sport of basketball, it's amazing to me how much Slats' teams and some of the things that Ralph's teams experienced and saw. Hey, it's just, and Paul Valenti as well in that 65-66 season. It's a wonderful heritage, and Jim Jarvis is a big part of it. And this week in Oregon State men's hoops feels as though we are honoring a great arc of the history of the program, and here's how. Now, we're going to have Bree Galvez on from the OSU marketing arm in promotional game presentation and events, because there's a lot of stuff going on this weekend with respect to all four games. It's a huge weekend for basketball. Thursday, men's hoops. Friday, women's hoops. Saturday, men's hoops. Sunday, women's hoops again. And each day features great promotions that Beaver Nation, I know, will want to be a part of and not miss out on. So Bree will join us to kind of give us an outline. We're trying to set a time, but tomorrow probably, with all of the events beginning to unfold on Thursday. The Diamond Dinner is Friday. That's a sign that the baseball season, this highly anticipated baseball season, a top 10 program, just around the corner, getting underway. But Friday night's sort of the tip-off, it feels like, to all of that. And Dominic Cusumano from the Dugout Club will join us to talk about this year's program. And even though there are no more tickets available, there are auction items, online auction items, and other things that even if you can't go, you can look in on and maybe make a contribution to the Beaver baseball program as we all get ramped up and excited about what's ahead in this 2024 last round in the Pac-12 for Beaver baseball. And Beaver baseball's plans, at least at this point, as they've been articulated, to continue with its great brand, its great program as an independent, while other teams have found places in the WCC and the alliance with the Mountain West, Beaver baseball is going to plot, as the man once said about this show, plot their own course.
That's right.
And do a great job of it. So a lot to get to as the week continues. Mark Radford will join us later in the week. And as it turns out, when I talk about the rich history, John, of Beaver basketball and being reminded of it this week and preparing for the honoring of the 60th anniversary Final Four team, which, quite frankly, was in the works last year because technically 62-63, 2023, it became a logistical schedule. They couldn't find an open date where people could come. So we're actually on the 61st anniversary, technically,
to call it 60.
But it's the 60th anniversary, as it were, of the 63-64 team that went to the Final Four under the legendary Slats Gill, for whom the building is named. And Mike Stevenson sent us, Mike from Seattle, a tremendous article from another August publication we talked about yesterday, Sports Illustrated, from the 61-62 season, the year before their breakthrough to the Final Four, writing about Terry Baker, Bob Jacobson, Rex Benner, and others in Mel Counts. And Slats himself and his salt and his tea after a cardiac event in 1960, cut down on coffee and smoking and different other things, began to drink tea instead with salt in his tea. That's all chronicled in Sports Illustrated in a way that only SI in their glory days could write the great feature stories, talking about Mary's Peak and the river and the town and Slats going downtown and meeting with fans at different places. Just an excellent
article. Things we just didn't know.
Right, and bringing us into the scene for Slats and his team, which included Jim Jarvis, who will join us, and Mel Counts, we hope. I'm hoping to hear from Big Mel. Mark Radford will join us later in the week. But in saying all of that, speaking of the rich history, one of the people behind the scenes for so many years, beginning in 1964, Kim Hoover, by the way, will join us later in the week as well. We're kind of trying to set a time with Kim. Class of 77, Crescent Valley High School, good friends with my dear friend, the late John Wilson, Yako. We talked about him, and Jimmy Wilson's older, one of Jimmy's older brothers. We lost John, just such a sad, premature end for a great man in John Wilson out of Crescent Valley in class of 77, and a dear friend to me and a former roommate and a friend for life. But Kim and John were close. Kim was close with the entire Wilson family, Jimmy and Bobby and John, and Wendy maybe too, for all I know. But she will join us to talk about her mother. And her mother's name is Ann Harper, who is turning 95 and was a secretary in the Oregon State basketball athletics program, Kim was telling me earlier today that in 1964, when she joined what they then called the secretarial pool, you got to imagine the office is now when you walk into Gill, and not the ticket office, but the ticket windows when you go to buy stuff at Gill. There was an office there that featured secretaries for all sports. It wasn't like you didn't have a dedicated sport. Mm-hmm. You were just secretaries available to all the sports and all the coaches housed there in Gill. So Ralph would walk over, or not Ralph, but Slats or Tommy Jack Riley, whomever. Ralph Coleman, pardon me, would walk over and make their request. Can you get this typed up? I need this. Can you do this? Can
to
you...
one office with a bunch of secretaries.
Yeah, and then whoever, okay, here, you take it. When Ralph got here, so you would kind of do work for all sports.
Yeah.
When Ralph got here, almost the beginning of this, in a sense, almost more than anything else, tells me we're beginning to move into a modern era. Because when Ralph got here for the beginning of his 19-year run for the 70-71 season, I want my own dedicated. I want my own secretary for my sport. And Ann Harper became that secretary to men's basketball, moved into the offices so he could be adjacent. But isn't that, John, almost more than anything else? We're moving into a modern era now.
The first big ask.
Yeah.
Kind of like you hear now that, you know, coaches will want something that's out of the ordinary. Maybe not long after getting your own secretary, it was getting your own car.
Right. Or even your own office.
Or your own office. That's just strange. I can't even imagine that. The only thing it reminds me of is the movie Hidden Figures, when all of the calculators, they called them calculators, were in one room figuring out all the numbers for different things for NASA.
Right.
But I've never really heard of a situation where executives, because that's what they are, didn't have their own. And that's strange.
So Ralph helps bring Oregon State Athletics into the modern era by saying, I need my own dedicated secretary to our sport. We have enough issues and things going on.
I wonder if management at the time, I don't know who the AD was in 70, but just goes,
That isn't the way we've done it.
It's not, can we, Mary, can we do this?
Well, Ralph got his way, and Ann Harper began what has become a legendary career.
Bill Harper's wife?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
And just such a great Oregon State family through the years. And the joy and the love that will be poured out to Ann this weekend. She'll be introduced Saturday.
Oh, nice.
At the Arizona State game, the 60th anniversary team and Ann Harper together. So it's a celebration of the history, the rich history of Oregon State basketball. And Ann, you know, I've talked to a number of people this morning on a couple of other, and we'll talk about the why and the wherefore, the celebration of Oregon State at basketball this weekend, Thursday, Arizona in town, Arizona State on Saturday. It's tinged now, indeed, and overshadowed by some very sad news with the passing of Rob Holbrook.
Saw that on Twitter yesterday. I was shocked.
Yeah, we all were. I've talked to Andy a little bit today. Andy McCloskey is always he's been such a connector to us, to generations of players and former players, and he himself has been on the show a number of times. Andy said that he and other teammates had lost a little bit of touch with Rob over the last few years, that there was a bit of a reclusive. He said Rob was kind of reclusive by nature, but a great teammate and a great guy and a tremendous shooter, 6'8" shooter, no three-point baskets in those days, but he could have hit from that range, but a very good outside shooter for a big man and was very important in Ralph's system in terms of being a big that could shoot.
I was always, I always knew of Rob, watched him play as, you know, as a growing up, 78 to 82. Had forgotten or didn't even know that he was a four-year pitcher.
For the baseball team.
Yeah. In fact, he got drafted twice.
How about that? He's known because of Oregon State basketball and its greatness in his era.
Yeah.
That's what we think of Rob Holbrook as, but Beaver baseball had some very good years in those years with Jack Riley, and Ralph relented, and When basketball's over, yeah, you can go ahead and pitch. Go ahead and do your baseball thing. And gave Rob that liberty, and Rob was good enough that Jack said, yeah, we'll take him when he's ready.
Yeah.
In mid-March, usually.
Now, Daschle had a good article on this.
Yes, he did.
And I was a little confused about the part where Bob Holbrook, who is Rob's father, was his baseball coach, and they came to see him. Jack Riley went to see the catcher. I'm assuming we're talking high school, and he went to see the high school catcher, and then he says, well, what about that pitcher?
Right.
Was that a situation where Bob would say, well, that's my son?
Yeah. Well, Jack said, well,
like him.
Like Matt Dillon, and there's something about, I kind of like him. Except I kind of like her. Anyway, he kind of liked him, and it's again, the whole... Yeah, I can't even go there. I was going to talk about Jim Gilstrap and a great story about going to recruit a center and then saying, who's that quarterback?
Oh, yeah.
I've kind of forgotten who that was. Anyway, good morning, everybody, and welcome into the Joe Beaver Show. It's a busy schedule, as I mentioned. But Ann Harper was this person as the secretary for Ralph that kept – Ralph knew he needed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy was telling me that Ralph never made a phone call, never took a phone call, and everything went through Ann. And so it's like,
as it should.
Yeah, without Ann, Ralph wouldn't have been able to function, essentially.
Yes.
And then Ann continued to work and worked with Jimmy, and then Eddie's first year or couple of years.
Wow.
So she spanned the eras, the decades. In a rich tradition of Oregon State basketball, and she's turning 95.
She started in 70 with Ralph, or before that in the pool?
In 64, in the secretarial pool.
Okay.
And then Ralph, whether Ralph said, I want that one. I mean, I'm not sure how that all played out.
She would have been with the group that Slats was coaching.
Yes, might have been. I think she may have missed Slats. Slats' final year was 63-64. Paul took over in 64-65. So she may have missed Slats, but she would have known... She would have known Tommy in football in his last year with the Beavers in 64, and then the ensuing run of coaches, for a while, with D, would have been kind of in that secretarial pool with D until Ralph said, I want my own, and Ann became his own secretary. And according to Kim, who will join us, Ann's daughter, later in the week, to kind of talk about what it meant to grow up in this wonderful Beaver household of Bill and Ann Harper. And Ann still lives, this is amazing to me and sweet, Ann still lives in the same house in Northwest Corvallis that Bill and Ann had built by Bob Gilder's father in 1965. And she's still on her own in that home at the age of 95.
Small world bringing in Gilder and... amazing you can still live in a home at 95. That's really good.
But as I mentioned, all of this is tinctured while we're celebrating richness. And Jim Jarvis will talk about great days. Bill McShane will join us here in a few minutes to talk about great days and teams. But primarily, and he'll talk about Ann as well.
Sure.
Because the players loved her, and there was always a buzz around her desk and around her office, players coming and going, having their own needs. Hey, I got this, I got that. She was sort of, to some of the players, a mom away from home, taking care of things that they needed.
Yeah, there's, I mean, a good executive assistant is worth their weight in gold. Absolutely, they know. They can. It has to be a thing where they know what you want. Before you want it. And it's to this day this is happening. Executives all around have the great executive assistants, and that's kind of what their role is to know everything about what they do
and be
respected.
Be ready.
Our own Dougie talks about, being able to just go over there. Now, this isn't so much about Ann. It was more about Ralph. But he'd say, well, Ann, is Ralph in? I mean, unannounced. Well, let me see. And then he would get past her as the gatekeeper.
Sure.
And go in and interview Ralph.
Sweet time, sweet days.
It was, yeah.
And there was a sweetness to all of this. And I'm sure Ann herself, I don't know if she's listening today, but she would be, with all of us, very saddened by the news about Rob, who went in and out of those offices, I'm sure, too. Rob Holbrook passing away yesterday, a cardiac event.
That's what it
speculates. And there hasn't. And that's just, It's just very sad news about a guy that, according to Andy, and we'll talk to Bill McShane about this in a moment, a walk-on from Park Rose.
Yeah. Well, originally.
He walked on originally from Park Rose.
But as I read, he was he had like an all-star game in the summer or something. They had originally said you could walk on with us. And then Ralph went to watch and sat next to Bob Holbrook at this all-star event in the summer. And then after the game, Ralph says, you'll be hearing from us.
Yeah.
And not long after Jimmy called, and they did offer him a scholarship.
Yeah, as well they should. He was a key player for a while. He got a little, I wouldn't say lost in the shuffle, but as the talent level.
It was a deep team.
He was a starter early in his career. He played a lot of significant minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Bill McShane can kind of get into all of this, but Andy was telling me about poor Rob as a freshman, was just getting beat up by Tony Martin and Bill McShane would wear him out as a young kid coming in out of Park Rose. So Bill will share some of his memories of Rob Holbrook, and it's just a sad thing to say, memories of.
I know.
When we're talking about a young man, what was he, 65?
63.
63, right. He's a couple of years younger than me.
I just lost a classmate that I found out a couple days ago. And I can't determine, you know, if it was a surprise. I think it was. And so, I mean, it makes you think,
I know.
Okay.
I know. Send not for whom the bell tolls.
Yeah.
Bill McShane to join us. Jenny Kavnar. Kavnar's kind of sandwiched in between these Oregon State legendary type figures and eras in a different sort of subject. However, a person with a good soul who I think will just be kind of right in with what we try to do on the show and tell stories and share people who have interesting experiences in their lives and professions to share. Jenny, voice of the Rockies. I think she's only 34 years of age, very talented. I hope she did a good job. I'll just believe that she did on the broadcast the other night from Boulder working with Matt Muehlbach. But she'll share some of her thoughts about her life and experience as a young, rising broadcaster at 1205. And Jim Jarvis of the Final Four team of 63-64 under the great Slats Gill. That's all coming up today. We take a break and visit with Bill McShane next on The Joe Beaver Show. Thanks for joining us today on The Joe Beaver Show. Mike Parker and John Warren. We have a busy guest list this week, as I've already talked about, with Jenny Kavnar at 12:05, Jim Jarvis coming up at 12:30. Mark Radford is booked and will join us later in the week. Mel Counts. We still have the invitation dangled to the great Mel Counts, and we hope to hear from him soon. So many are coming back to Gill Coliseum. We believe Mel is among them this weekend, celebrating the Final Four team, and then many are coming, including our next guest, to celebrate the great career of Ann Harper, who turns 95 this year and was Ralph Miller's personal secretary and then worked in that same capacity as we talked about with Jimmy and then with Eddie Payne in his first couple of years. So Bill McShane knows this well. And while we celebrate, and we've already touched on this as we welcome Bill in, we celebrate Ann Harper's life. We celebrate the Final Four team this weekend. But Big Bill, you were part of some great teams for the late, great Ralph Miller at Oregon State. All of us, I think, are saddened. I know you are, and I certainly was taken aback by the news with respect to your teammate on those great teams, Rob Holbrook, passing away at the age of 63. So that certainly does sort of color all of us, our perspectives heading into the weekend. I'm sure it does for you. A lot we want to talk to you about, Bill, but let's begin, first of all, with your reaction to that news about Rob and your thoughts about Rob as a person and a teammate.
Hello there, Mike.
Hey, Bill.
And I want to tell you that Rob was, that was a shock we all had last week, learning about his passing. Totally unexpected. I will say that Rob was a fantastic teammate. He always had a smile on his face and was quick to laugh. He was one of the more fun teammates. I had. His role was to make Ralph's system work by shooting his set shot from the corners, and he did a damn good job of that. But we'll miss his, he just had a real sense for life and wanting to have fun.
Hey, Bill, Andy was telling me, Andy Mikulski, that early in Rob's career, he had a tough time of it battling you and Tony Martin in practices. That Ralph would put Rob in and Tony beat up on him. You'd come back in for Tony after you guys had been battling each other, and you'd get the best of Rob in those early matchups. Do you remember that? Do you remember it that way a little bit, that Rob early was going up against some big, strong, competitive players like you and Tony?
Well, that's true. However, Rob was a pretty smart guy, and he realized that life was a lot easier outside of the paint instead of coming in to fight Tony and I. So that encouraged him to stay out there 18 to 21 feet and bomb away, and he was very comfortable doing that. He said, "Billy, why would I come in and fight you guys when I can go out there and shoot jumpers?"
And Andy was telling me, too, that skill, as you've already alluded to, Bill, was very important for those Pac-10 championship teams. Would you concur?
Oh, absolutely. It was. I would say it was a significant part of helping make Ralph's system work to take the pressure off the inside. So then once he and others on the team start hitting those jumpers, then it kind of opened it up for the postmen, including Steve, to do their work.
You know, Bill and Bill McShane, our guest, you guys were part of such a memorable era in Oregon State athletics and basketball history that the bond you share, even if you don't see each other or talk to each other a lot in the ensuing years, some of you probably do, but having been teammates in those years with Rob and your other teammates, Bill, throughout the rest of your life, what has that meant to you?
Well, I think either whether you grew up here in the Northwest or, like myself, transferred in, it gave us a sense of home, and we continued the camaraderie. We started down in Corvallis. We still get together regularly. That's why the news about Rob's passing was such a shock, because we had been in touch with him as recently as a few months ago, and we expected to see him. We did not see him at that particular gathering, but we do get together, and it's just the camaraderie that we share is something that is irreplaceable.
You know, this has happened, and I don't know, you know, he passed on January 15th, so it's been a little while. Did it take a little while for the news to get to all of you, Bill? Or were you aware of it immediately, all the teammates, or did it take a little while for the news to travel?
Well, there was a little bit of hesitancy just because it's tough to share that kind of news, mm-hmm. but I found out within the week, and then I think we all shared that information, so we were in shock and in awe that reality had struck. We're so sorry to lose Rob, but I will say this, I'm very confident with all the communication we had with him over the years, he lived life on his terms.
And according to his father, Bob, he loved the Beavers. Whether we saw him at a lot of games or not, and I didn't over the years, to be honest with you, Bill, I didn't see him like I saw you when Kevin was playing, and I saw you recently when you came back with Kevin for an event for the USC game with Radford and Bloom and others. It was so great to see you, and always has been. I didn't see him as much, but it sounds as though, according to Bob Holbrook, that the Beavers were always near and dear to his heart.
Well, that's certainly true, and I don't think that anything will maybe personify that better. We were playing up at Pullman at Washington State, and the students had decided they were going to just interrupt our warm-up and take over our half of the court. And I had heard about Robbie being a good pitcher, but I'd never seen it. And he said, "Billy, go across the way there, and I'm going to throw you a fastball, but right before I throw it, I'm going to give you a nod and go down to tie your shoes." So I did that, and I think his fastball ricocheted off about 10 Washington State students, and wouldn't you know it, they cleared out the court and let us warm up.
Now that's a first. That's a first. I've not heard that story before. That's a great story about his accuracy to get 10 with one basketball throw. Thanks for that, Bill. Were there more hijinks in those days? Do you remember, were you on the team when George put on Don to, George Raveling Don to you know, sweats and went through the lineup and the routine and was trying to get the crowd all into it. Do you remember hijinks along those lines in those days?
Yeah, absolutely. And George was quite a colorful guy. We could always expect him to bring some kind of color to the game or the event. I was there that day, and he was trying to keep his team loose because we were bringing the heat, and he was doing anything he can to try and stay relevant.
You know, the sense I got as we visit with Bill McShane, I don't know how we're going to talk about Ann here in a moment, Bill, but the Ralph Miller way and system, and we've touched on this with you before. You said the way to make Ralph's system work and so on, a system-oriented coach, also a tough coach, would bark at you, throw somebody to the scorer's table to replace somebody who just took a bad or ill-advised shot. In the main, how was he when you look back at the years under him? How do you regard the years in terms of the type of man, coach, person he was, what you learned from him? Are there some things you still have some ambivalence about playing for him?
No, I can assure you there's I can assure you there's no ambivalence. Ralph was very clear in his communications. We all knew exactly where we stood. I'm not saying it always tasted real good, but we all knew what was in front of us, and he was a very direct communicator. He needed to be to make his system work. He empowered his system more than he did playing the game. And that was a hallmark of his success is, he had forgotten more about basketball than we knew as young kids coming in there. And he commanded complete respect all the time, not some of the time, all the time. And it helped me understand how to galvanize my character of who I wanted to be, seeing a strong man like that deliver the messages he did all the time.
You know, Bill, I think about those transcendent teams, the Pac-10 championship teams of 79 and 80, 80, 81. But then I can't help but think about those days without that tincture of sadness about the first round exits against Lamar and Kansas State. And people have tried to say, well, that's where the system in the end didn't serve the program as well. You needed to have a little more looseness. The guys were too tight in those games. I mean, do you put any stock in those kinds of theories when people look back and say, why didn't those teams go further in the tournament?
No, I think there might be some truth in that because we I think, understood what Coach Miller wanted, and I think we ran it as well or better than anybody. Certainly the guys that came right after us advanced further in the tournament, and there's been some talk about how Lester kept them loose. I think there's some combination of us being tight in that game, but also I think there's some truth to the game plan and the rotation was slightly changed in that game against Kansas State, which is the one I think you're referring to.
Yeah, and Lamar the year before that, you know, when you got beat by a fast and loose Billy Tubbs team that gave you all kinds of problems.
No, and that's another part of Ralph's message. You got to go in there and respect your opponent every day. And it's not that we didn't expect them, respect them, but it is true that if you don't bring your best game at that level, beat. And those were unfortunate days because neither one of those were our best days for sure.
Right. And in the 80-81 team, Jimmy says it's still that game, that loss to Kansas State is the one that's been hardest for him and maybe for all of you to live on with. Because did you feel, Bill, when you rode herd over the country for 2 months of that season, did you guys think going into the tournament, hey, we're good enough to get to the Final Four and maybe win the whole darn thing?
Yeah, we had a lot of confidence. Every time we walked on the floor that year, we were pretty sure we were going to win. So there wasn't a whole lot of doubt in our mind of where we were headed. That's why I agree it made that loss significantly hard.
Bill, let's close with a thought. We're going to talk to Kim Harper, Kim Hoover, later in the week about her mother, Ann, turning 95. And I'm just wondering, Bill, you know, you, Mark Radford, and others have worked to rally and make sure that the life of Ann Harper gets properly acknowledged. And this won't even touch the impact and effect. It's a great event that Oregon State is putting on with the help of former players such as yourself and Mark and others. Well, what did she mean to you, and the kind of a glue, it sounds like, in everything that happened in Oregon State basketball for a long time?
She was such a fun person. She was always smiling, always getting her work done, always available. She was just a blanket of warmth and love to help us kind of stabilize all the stuff we were going through in terms of learning how to be good disciplined players for Ralph. And we're probably way overdue in doing this, but Annie was really the glue that held us together as a family.
Yeah, and I've heard, too, that there's photographs of her with a whole bunch of basketballs that Lester was supposed to sign, that Ann was very circumspect about doing things the right way, making sure she was sort of the one-person compliance officer. We're not doing that. You're not going there. No, you can't do that. Do you remember having any conversations along those lines with her?
Yeah, absolutely. She was very dutiful in her progress in getting her job done. Like we all in Beaver Nation want, you know, do your job. And she was good at that. But she did it with grace. Mm-hmm. And there was never any fuss. There was never any whining or complaining. She was always just a joy to be around.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, it's going to be fun to see you again with Kevin. I hope it was great to see you guys together recently for the USC game coming in this weekend. I'm just wondering, again, with the cross generations of Beavers, the Final Four team to be honored and to be honored, a lot of teammates are coming in. You were expecting Rob to be here, and now that's sad that that will not happen. But I hear Jeff Stout's coming, and there's a lot of different players of different eras coming. Is that your sense of things, Bill, this Saturday?
It absolutely is. We're coming down there primarily to support the program and have a presence in that because we want to see them do well. I think the closest that many of us will ever get to the Final Four is being around our teammates who actually were there or alumni who were there. And we want to make sure that we recognize Annie for all her work. So we're looking to take this program to higher heights. It's time to get back to our winning ways. It's certainly what Beaver Nation is deserving. What a great fan base. I mean, we just got to work harder at getting the job done.
We appreciate you kind of, you know, and Roberto Nelson, from what Mark's told me, has been instrumental as a figure on Wayne's staff as the director of player development to kind of make sure that all of you are still, like you said, Bill, involved in trying to make Beaver basketball the best that it can be. Do you have a sense that Roberto has a feel for that and is doing a good job in that role?
Roberto has been a fantastic ombudsman for the program, reaching out to us and taking our calls and just helping us through our ideas of developing the program. He's doing a great job. We're very happy he's there, and I'm hoping he's there long enough to enjoy some of the success that all this hard work will bring.
Bill, great to talk to you. Say hi to Kevin for us. We'll see you guys at the game this weekend. Thanks for taking time, Bill. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate you so much and all you do for Beaver Nation.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Bill McShane, our guest. There are calls out. Roberto's told me he's talked with A.C. Green, with Gary Payton. They're going to do what they can to try to get there Saturday because, again, that just tells you about the impact of a life.
Oh, yeah.
Ann Harper.
Yeah.
Kind of the rallying point to bring. If you get A.C. and Gary in the building at the same time, we've seen it here and there over the years. But I think Roberto is recognizing, as Bill just touched on, that men's basketball has been one of the, in the history of Oregon State Athletics, some of the success level, the championships, the very first ever championship won by the Beavers as a member of a conference once known as the PCC.
Mm-hmm.
The Beavers are charter member, the Pacific Coast Conference. The very first championship won by a team at Oregon State was in 1933 with Slats.
The first of
in
five,
basketball.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, he was a championship level coach, mm-hmm. Final mm-hmm. Four in 49. Final Four in 63, and his final year, 25-5 and out. Goes 25-5 and calls it a career and becomes the AD. Unfortunately, Slats passed away just a couple of years after his retirement. Paul Valenti took the reins. Paul did a tremendous job. And so we're going to see a lot of legends returning yeah. this weekend. We're going to talk to one of them in Jim Jarvis, part of a Final Four team in the 62-63 season. Jenny Kavnar, in between, you know, Bill McShane and Jarvis,
mm-hmm.
and then here's Jenny Kavnar, sort of in the middle. She'll join us at 12:05. Let's take a break. Any thoughts you'd like to share? What do you guys remember about the role of and the talents and skill set of Rob Holbrook, both as a pitcher? Kip, do you have anything on him as a pitcher? Or you remember? Big guy, 6'8".
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know much about Rob as a pitcher. I know him as a good shooter in the Ralph Miller system.
I just remember him shooting from the old spot, which is three-point line now.
He would have been a good three-point shooter out of the corners, as Billy was talking about. 753-56, 497-5356. If you'd like to join us either via the University Honda text line or Downward Dog phone line. Great to be with you on the Joe Beaver Show on Joe Radio. Rob Holbrook, a two-sport athlete who played for 4 years for the basketball and baseball teams, passed away last week. The story, and I don't know if that's Nick Daschle's story that you printed out. Yes, it is. Yeah. Nick does a great job of covering all things Oregon State. And he wrote in the second paragraph, Holbrook, 63, was a member of the Oregon State's Orange Express basketball teams that routinely challenged for Pac-10 titles and NCAA tournament berths under Coach Ralph Miller. The 6'8 Holbrook also pitched 4 years for OSU baseball for Coach Jack Riley. Holbrook died on January 15th of what was thought to be a cardiac event. Mm. According to his father, Bob Holbrook, Holbrook worked for Oregon Youth Authority in Woodburn and lived in Oregon City.
Never married and no kids.
Bob says in this article by Nick, Bob Holbrook said Rob's primary interest was Oregon State sports. Quote, he really loved Oregon State. He watched all the football and basketball games. Sports was about the only thing he was really interested in, unquote, Bob Holbrook said. Ooh. That's why I brought up with Bill about what I didn't see. He wasn't a guy that we interact occasionally with some former players from that special era.
Right.
He was not one of them.
I thought he was. I thought you knew him.
I did not know him well.
Andy and Bill.
I've met him once or twice, but no.
Okay, well, I thought it was interesting that I remember watching him play.
Yes,
so
good shooter.
To read about him is fascinating. They won the state title in 78
at Park Rose.
Just a few years later, they won it again because it was over my alma mater.
With Woodside
in the spring of 83. And so that was a time period when you had Bloom and Radford. Did Bloom and Radford go to Park Rose?
No, Radford went to Grant.
Grant and Park Rose. I remember going and watching those guys at the tournament that year when I was in grade school, whatever it was, but junior high. No, it's just I was shocked. I was shocked because now we're getting into knowing people and knowing players and having memories of watching them play. One paragraph here, Miller offered Holbrook a walk-on opportunity during his senior year, but Holbrook had a final chance to impress as he earned the most valuable player honors in the annual Metro State Basketball Series. Bob Holbrook said Miller sat with him during the game, noting the improvement in his son. Afterward, Miller talked to Rob, "You'll be hearing from us," Miller said. Bob Holbrook said assistant coach Jimmy Anderson called shortly thereafter with a scholarship offer.
You think about all the things that might have been and could have been with respect to coaches' decisions by people, where to go to school and why and what sport to play. In this case with Rob, he played both. I was reading about Pat Casey in a great article by Kerry Eggers. The beauty of Kerry's life now, writing at kerryeggers.com. Yeah. There's no word limit, let's just say. It's a little bit like Edward Bennett Williams when he hired the late, great George Allen, one of my heroes. He said about 6 months into George's tenure, as George was trying to get the Redskins to the Super Bowl, and George didn't take too kindly to this comment and even got a... Edward Bennett Williams introduced George at a Redskins company event or whatever and said, "Here's George Allen, my new coach. I gave him an unlimited budget, and he's already exceeded it." And George gets up and says, "Well, don't you want the Redskins to win a championship? I mean, that's what you hired me for. I'm doing whatever I can to do it." So yeah, I don't even know how did I, oh, Carrie doesn't have a, yeah. There's no,
no.
These are deep dive articles and
no
they're
deadlines.
Great, but you've got to kind of, it's a little bit like sometimes, and I have to find the right time and place now
yes.
to read them.
Yes.
Because as Tom Boswell pointed out years ago, you remember a thing called the National Sports
yeah.
Daily?
Yeah.
That it didn't last long. And it was almost at the end of newspapers' primacy, mm-hmm. and they tried to come out with the biggest thing in the history of life, the National Sports Daily, with all these articles and notes and information.
Yeah.
And Boswell opined, whenever that was, 91, 92, or 3, a great writer with the Washington Post, Boswell said, well, I've learned something. I can either have a life or I can read the National Sports Daily every day. It's one or the other.
For one of the early incarnations of something like The Athletic.
Yes.
But
great stuff.
It was great, but it just didn't last.
And we were already on this, got to get my information quickly mode.
Yeah, yeah.
Even before.
But it was before
Twitter.
The internet.
It was before the internet. It was, but we were still, I think, accustomed to, conditioned by television and quick moving imagery, whatever.
Although,
else.
At the time, like we talked about yesterday, Sports Illustrated,
still,
Sporting News, you had to wait for it to come
that's
out.
That's true. You'd wait a week, but the daily nature of what the National was asking you to do was too much.
Yeah.
It was all good. Great writers.
Well, it's not unlike today.
With all the stuff available.
With the fire hose of information coming at us, you know, it's like you can't take it all in. There's enough people out there where everybody, one person out of the entire audience has seen something, so that if you're hosting a show like this or doing whatever, somebody else is going to know something you don't know because they read it and you didn't.
And the internet and all of the sites, The Athletic and the various other sports, are niche enough that you can find your place and your audience. You know, for example, I was fascinated by something I read earlier today about Joel Embiid's big game last night, breaking Wilt's record. Only 70? Was it 70 or 71?
70.
70. And that broke Wilt Chamberlain's Sixer scoring record. I thought, come on, Wilt, you got to score more than that. But that was Wilt's prime with the Sixers was a little after he'd been doing his scoring 50 points per game thing.
Well, his record was 67 in 67, I think it was.
The 66-67.
But his 100 points was the Philadelphia Warriors.
The Warriors, exactly. So that's for a moment I had to pause when I said Joel Embiid broke Wilt's record. No, yeah, okay, he did, the Philadelphia Warriors.
And he
Warriors.
Only had one three-pointer.
Who, last night?
Yeah, 1 for 2 from three.
He made one
70.
Three?
Yes.
Okay. But then there's another article about Karl Anthony Towns scoring 62.
Same, yes,
but
he did.
Cost his team the game because he shot too much.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
In these contentious times,
sir, you have asked a simple-minded question. I will give you an equally simple-minded answer.
We invite you to escape for the next couple of hours into the world of the Joe Beaver Show, with your hosts, John Warren and Mike Parker, and occasionally, Doug Blair.
All right, man, we're not here to sell lemonade, we're here to practice.
No one breaks it down any better.
Old Indian game. It's called, put the ball in the hole.
What are these little arrows?
Let Joe Beaver be your guide into the bold new world of technology.
Radio. That's gonna break down a lot of walls.
Yes?
The door is wide open.
Recreation time, gentlemen.
So come on in. Be a part of the Joe Beaver Show on the home of the Beavers, 1240 Joe Radio.
Into the second hour of our show, Jim Jarvis, Oregon State Hall of Famer, out of Roseburg High, great player, coach, played in the ABA with Connie Hawkins.
Ooh.
And we haven't talked a lot played with Connie. Connie
Ooh.
Was a teammate of Jim Jarvis's with the Pittsburgh Pipers.
I don't know
if
he's mentioned in Connie's book, Foul, one of the thickest sports books you'll ever see.
It's a great book, and we'll see. But Jim will join us to talk about the 60th anniversary of the Beavers' Final Four team at 12:30. We had the honor of visiting with Bill McShane from the Pac-10 champion Beavers, 79-80, 80-81. And in between today, I'm really looking forward to the conversation with our next guest. I had the pleasure of meeting Jenny Kavnar with Matt Muehlbach before the Beavers game in Boulder on Saturday afternoon. and I did not get a chance to hear the broadcast or watch their work. I was across the way doing the radio play-by-play. But in the few minutes that I had with Jenny, I was so impressed by her graciousness, by her love for somebody that I grew up admiring and loving, as so many of us did, the late and brilliant Vin Scully, that I knew that this was a person who, just sort of a kindred spirit, somebody that kind of views this whole thing that we are blessed to be involved with, sportscasting, in a somewhat similar way in terms of the way Vinny in his life carried himself not only as the greatest broadcaster ever, but as a person. That was the thing that Jenny conveyed most to me, and I really appreciated her saying it. She's kind enough to join us to talk about that, her work with the Rockies and the MLB Network and more. Jenny, it was a real pleasure to meet you, and thanks for taking time for our show today. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me. I am sitting here on pins and needles waiting to see if Todd Helton gets into the Hall of Fame today. So that's kind of where I am, a picture in the world in the Rocky Mountain region. But thanks for having me on in Oregon.
Yeah, and Jenny, thank you. Let's start right there, because it sort of takes you to your early days in love for the sport of baseball. Am I right in terms of Todd and some other players that meant a lot to you when you first started going to games? Tell us a little bit about those days.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Colorado, and my dad is a longtime high school baseball coach. So when we found out when I was about 9, 10 that we were going to get a major league team here in Colorado, he, of course, was all in, bought season tickets with some friends, and we started going to games very early at Mile High and then eventually at Coors Field. And so for me, it was Larry Walker and Andres Galarraga and Vinny Castilla, and then eventually, you know, Todd Helton came along, and our seats were, in fact, right up from first base. So often, you know, in watching Todd as a fan, it was his defense that I admired more than anything. We know the guy could hit, any given morning, but it was really the defensive aspect. And then as I got into broadcasting and, you know, been a major league broadcaster for 17 years, I, you know, was lucky enough to come back to my home state and cover the Rockies, and it was Todd last year. So getting to know him and his family in the clubhouse and, maintaining a relationship and keeping in touch all these years, I know today is a really important day for them. And I'm really hopeful that he'll get over the top. It's going to be one or two votes once again, one way or another. But, people often want to make the case of playing all your games at altitude and, you know, why you shouldn't get in. But I think Larry Walker kind of trumped any sort of argument that is when he got into Cooperstown a couple years ago.
Well, you have some journalistic responsibilities later when the expected good news comes in for Todd. 1,406 RBIs, 1,401 runs, 369 career homers, a batting average of .316. Mile High or not, those are Hall of Fame numbers. So he should make it. When he does, are you going to be covering it in some way, and on what platforms?
Yeah, I'll be covering it. Well, I'll be doing a lot of local radio around the state of Colorado today, reactionary radio, and then I work on MLB Network Radio. We've been doing a deep dive into all potential Hall of Famers, so we'll have a lot of reaction throughout the course of the week.
Who else has a good – I haven't, to be honest with you, so preoccupied with Oregon State stuff, I haven't dived into the Hall candidacy. Who else – do you expect, first of all, so close as he came last year, that Todd's going to get the good news today?
Well, I think in regards to Todd, you know, last year it was, he'll make a big leap from the year before, but he definitely won't get in. And then the day of, you're like, oh, my gosh, he was a couple votes shy of getting in. I think it shocked a lot of people to where he was then on the trajectory to get in today. And unfortunately, the way voting goes, you know, some of these ballots are public, and the great Ryan Thibodeau is a good follow on Twitter. He kind of updates all the public ballots, and they do their own projections. And he really has Todd within, you know, plus or minus one or two votes. And that's why I say he's going to be on the fence. I don't think it's a shoo-in today. And I think that's what makes a lot of people around here kind of nervous. Mm-hmm. But in terms of others that will be getting into the Hall of Fame, Adrian Beltre, in my opinion, is a first ballot Hall of Famer. There's no doubt about it. He's tracking that way, and I think being on the ballot he will absolutely get in today, which will be really exciting for him. Billy Wagner's on his final year on the ballot, and I think that, you know, there's cause for concern that he actually dropped off a lot. Gary Sheffield also was getting closer, but I'm not sure that he will get in. Joe Mauer is right on the cusp as well. I think there's a strong possibility that we'll see him. You're talking about three or four that we'll be seeing getting into the Hall of Fame, which is pretty exciting.
Jenny Kabner joining us, play-by-play broadcaster of Fox Sports, the Pac-12 networks, and she did the Beaver game this past Saturday night, host and reporter at AT&T Sportsnet Rocky Mountain, host on Sirius XM MLB Network Radio, she's alluded to. Jenny, how do you demolish arguments, or do you, when you hear the mile-high argument against Todd's candidacy? What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, I get it. I get the era that he played in. You talk about part of it being pre-Humidor, most of it being post-Humidor. The numbers, you know, absolutely ridiculous in that time and place. But I think when you start to look at the fact that, there's a stat called park-adjusted OPS. His park-adjusted OPS was a 144 in the span of years that he was really good. And I'll just narrow that down to 1998 to 2007. A park-adjusted OPS of 144, that means that you are 44% better than the average player in Major League Baseball. And at times, that number jumped even higher up towards, you know, the 200 mark. So it's an excellent statistical, more just an analytical number that points to of why you can separate out him playing at altitude and playing at other parks. Now, when you just look at his raw numbers, his home road splits, his batting average on the road versus home, the overall, you know, totality of numbers and things, yeah, there's a huge discrepancy there. But I also think what really bums me out about all this over the course of time is you start to look at how certain ballparks play. And if you wanted to really discount, altitude and the effect that it had positively for offense, then you also need to do that in ballparks like Cincinnati. I mean, Great American Ballpark plays very small. There are a lot of home run hitters there for a reason. We've seen it year in and year out. You have to look at the West Coast and how the ball spins, and pitchers that have gotten into the Hall of Fame based on the stats or based on their statistics and their numbers that have come at sea level, right? We could do this on and on throughout the course of baseball. But I think for true writers that get the vote, they know the game. They're around the game. They talk to players in the game. And if you talk to any given player from Todd Helton's era, any given manager from Todd Helton's era, the eye test will tell you that he is a Hall of Fame player. And I think with the numbers, like I mentioned, the statistical numbers that back it up now as the analytics have progressed, that should be enough to tell you that he's over the hump.
Well, you already touched on it, and I was curious about it. And I'm wondering if you yourself came upon an appreciation of his tremendous defensive play, whether it's your dad saying, watch him, did you watch him just make play after play at first base and say, well, oh my goodness, that's really impressive? Did you have guidance into appreciating that, or did you just come upon that on your own? And does that also help his cause?
Yeah, it should help his cause. I mean, he's an all-around player, and I think that is the beauty of when you look at this game and go, okay, he could be, you're an all-star, great. You're in top 10 of MVP voting X amount of years, runner-up and rookie of the year, went to the World Series, led a team that should have had no business in the World Series to a World Series in 2007. But to me, I think it's the Gold Glove, the consistency of the Gold Glove for him in his prime years in the early 2000s. And yeah, I think anyone that went to the ballpark noticed it. I mean, Todd just had a knack for the ball. And playing first base, maybe not the most athletic position in terms of other positions around the diamond that you could get to. But I think that there's something that doesn't show up in staff to a baseball fan that you know when you're watching somebody that's just a level above and beyond their defensive position. And I felt that as a kid, right? I mean, like I said, I grew up watching Andres Galarraga there, and the big cat hit. That's what he did. And there was defense there, too, but it was different. It was different with Todd. And the era that he was in, I think he stood out amongst his peers defensively.
Jenny Kabner joining us here on the Joe Beaver Show. All right, so let's get into a little bit about your time. Our first experience with you on the Beaver game, are you doing just mountain games, and will we see you more often? on Pac-12?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of Pac-12 women's basketball. This is my only weekend of Pac-12 men's basketball. I had the Buffaloes in Oregon on Thursday night as well on Fox Sports 1, but my primary coverage of men's basketball is in the Mountain West Conference, so that's where I'll be finishing up this college basketball season.
When you were done collegiately at Colorado State, then what happened between graduating and getting to the level that you're at right now?
Yeah, I graduated from Colorado State in 2004. I bounced around at some local TV stations, even took my hand at coaching lacrosse. I played at Colorado State, so I coached at UCLA for a few years. Eventually landed my first baseball job in 2007 with the San Diego Padres, and really began my journey in baseball broadcasting. Was there from 2007 to 2011, and then got the call to come home and be a broadcaster for the Rockies in 2012. And in the last decade, I've always done college basketball, but within the last decade, expanded into the play-by-play role. In 2018, I got the chance to call a Major League Baseball game and use that offseason to get back behind the mic for basketball and just kind of worked in that way and added SiriusXM and MLB Network Radio to the portfolio and done some other broadcasts as well, but I primarily stick to baseball and college basketball.
Very cool. I want to ask you a quick selfish question. Being a fan of the Colorado Rockies as a youngster, do you remember Ben Petrick?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes, I do, and I met him along the way. I'm colleagues with Ryan Spielberg and Corey Sullivan, who played in an era where, they knew him and have introduced me to him, so yeah.
Yeah, he was a local kid, and I called a lot of his high school stuff 30 years ago, just before he signed with the Rockies and made his way through. A short career for health reasons, but great kid, and I just remember him with just a few years with the Rockies.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good Pacific Northwest kid,
yep,
is Bud Black, the manager of the Rockies.
Right. Excellent. Great guy, by the way, as you know. Jenny Kavanaugh with us for a few more minutes on a big day, potentially, for the history of the Rockies organization, the potential of Todd Helton's name being called for the Hall of Fame. A couple of other things here real quick. One, that was the first time Matt told me, and we've known Matt Muehlbach for a long time, really like him. I don't know. When you work with somebody for the first time, how did it go? I hope the answer is good and well, but I hope you found Matt to be a very a congenial, enjoyable person to work with.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm very excited that Matt and I both kind of cross-checked our schedules and realized we're both together again this weekend.
Oh, good.
In Albuquerque, and we'll have the New Mexico Lobos and Nevada down there at the Pit. So I'm really looking forward to working with Matt again. I've obviously watched his work. I have a lot of colleagues that I'm friends with who have also worked with him and, spoken very highly of him. But, yeah, his enthusiasm, just the joy that he exudes about basketball, and then again, just for people, is you can feel it right away. And so it was really fun to work together and have that opportunity.
And the one thing that I, when you mentioned your San Diego Padres experience, I mentioned Dick Enberg immediately. And then we talked more about Ted Leitner, the legend in that city. And we had a chance to visit with Ted when San Diego State played the Beavers in football. But we got around to somebody by the name of Vin Scully. And I could tell by the way you almost lit up, your eyes, your sense of appreciation for him was real. Tell us a little bit, Jenny, about your interactions with the greatest to ever do it in Vin Scully.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel so lucky that my entire baseball career as a broadcaster has been in the National League West. And that meant that, with the Padres or with the Rockies, I often got across paths with Vin Scully, and just as genuine of a person as you could imagine. A lot of times I think you fall in love with a voice on the radio or on the television, and sometimes you meet them, and sometimes it lives up to what you thought, sometimes it doesn't. Well, I'll say that Vin was a more gracious and wonderful person in real life than you could have ever imagined, and he was that way with everyone that he came across. But we created a special relationship, and he was very encouraging of me being a woman in this industry and, in my pursuits. And I appreciate all the time that he took with me to, mentor me and have some guidance or have some words of encouragement. But I just had this, really interesting feeling about his warmth and how I would love one day that if I had ever had a chance to raise a little boy, that it would be someone who would turn out to be like a Vin Scully, right? And my husband and I, we met through baseball, and my husband played professional baseball, and when he was done, we had met through mutual friends. And he grew up listening to Vin Scully on the radio. His dad was born in Pasadena, and they were huge Dodger fans growing up. And so, he had an affection for him as well. And I introduced him, to Vin at one point in time. And when it came around to us starting a family and having a baby, when we found out it was a boy, I said, I really want to name him Vincent. And, we decided to do that. And we call our son Vin. He goes by Vincent. But it's really special because I got the chance to write a Christmas card to Vin Scully and let him know that we did that. And he wrote me the most gracious letter back. And I put it in my son's baby book. And just to have that connection and that memory is so special.
Jenny, that's a great story. It was a real pleasure to meet you. I know I'm saddened that our conference, as we've known it, is after this season no more. But I hope down the road our paths will cross in other avenues and your broadcast during the basketball season. So it was a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you for the good work and good luck today with Todd. We hope for good news for you and the organization. Thanks for taking time for us here. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on and reaching out. I appreciate it.
Okay, good luck today. Jenny Kavnar, our guest, waiting on pins and needles, as she said, with respect to Todd Helton and his Hall of Fame candidacy. And she did mention not today, time didn't allow per se, but she talked about my life, her life in the National League West. And she said another person that was very good, kind, encouraging, and helpful to her was John Miller. Ooh. Of the Giants broadcast team, who always referred to Adrian Beltre as Adrian Beltre. Right?
She worked with two of the best ever.
Dick Enberg.
Three of the best.
Dick, Vin Scully, and John Miller. She worked with Dick a little bit with the Padres.
Mm-hmm.
But she got to know and interact with Vin on Padres-Dodgers games and then Padres-Giants games with the great John Miller.
I'd just like to be in the same press box as the great, late, great Vin Scully.
And Rich Burke, our good friend, was in the same press box at Wrigley with the one and only Harry Carey.
Really?
Yeah. He said his one and only interaction. Now, he had a little more time with Vin Scully through Peter Jacobson and the Fred Meyer Challenge at Vinny Player.
I don't know if Vinny ever came
up.
Challenge.
He didn't come up. No. Peter got Rich a job working a broadcast event that Scully was doing.
Oh.
So he got to interact with Vin and help Vin as a broadcast assistant or whatever else. And he said that was one of the coolest few days of his life, because Vinny was great. He said, was nice as can be, told a lot of stories. But he said the Harry Carey interaction was simply walking. He had a press pass to Wrigley, and he goes into and he starts to gather up the notes, does Rich. Yeah. Always, he's going to research. So he's got this release and that set of notes. Harry walks in, looks at him, young man, are you going to take something of everything? And that was it. yes, sir, Mr. Carey. Okay, good luck to you.
That's funny.
That's it. That's because his one and only everything. Interaction. Yeah, because that's probably a little different than Harry's approach.
Steve Stone took care of everything else. Those are great.
See, the problem is, for me, one of the problems with Harry, it's not even so much a problem, because he was one of the greatest to ever do it. I don't know if any of you heard Harry. And I would say, I know you loved him. Everybody loved him with the Cubs.
Yeah.
But there was an era before that with the Cardinals where he and Jack Buck together, Harry's play-by-play ability, unbelievably good.
Well,
not just the, you spell that name, man. We got to get some runs, became a caricature to the point that Will Ferrell is caricaturing him on Saturday Night Live.
I think the later years were the drinking years.
Well, they might have been drinking, going on a little early, too.
He was drinking in the booth,
yeah.
Which is a legal thing. If you're doing a broadcast, if you're in the only one who can't drink is the person in the studio pushing the buttons.
Huh?
But if you're a play-by-play or you're doing a remote somewhere, you can drink. And I think Harry knew that. And he got a little bit more soft as the game went along.
He would. True. You understand what I'm saying, though, about it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is.
It's sort of the
We saw the clown version versus the brilliant version.
The brilliant, one of the great broadcasters ever. And what we get now is if the moon were made of barbecued ribs or whatever. Yeah. The moon were made. We know the moon isn't made of green cheese, he says to Goldblum. But if it were made of barbecued spare ribs, would you eat it? What's your favorite planet? Mine's the sun.
He was probably having the most fun in his entire
career.
He
may have been.
In the end.
Will Ferrell imitating him is hilarious.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Harry was a little more than that.
Jonas Knox in the morning show does one of the best Harry characters I've ever heard.
Let's take a break. We'll come back with a legend who played with Connie Hawkins. He played baseball and basketball for the Beavers, as did the late Rob Holbrook. And we are still trying to come to grips with that startling news. And Bill McShane, we appreciate him joining us. We have other guests coming this week, but honored to be joined by Jim, part of the Final Four team from the 63-64 season, which will be honored this weekend at Gill Coliseum. Jim Jarvis next on the Joe Beaver Show. We continue on the Joe Beaver Show. Mike Parker with John Warren. What a week for Oregon State men's hoops coming up. Arizona Thursday night. The great Bill Walton will be in town to call the game. Bill has, I'll share the text maybe after our conversation with our next guest about why he can't be on the show. It's Walton-esque in response to the request. Even in saying no, it's entertaining enough. So we'll talk to Bill here, to Bill at some other point, he promised. Mark Radford and others are coming up later in the week. I have a request out to the great Mel Counts, who's expected to be at the event this weekend, not only honoring the 60th anniversary of a Final Four team, and Jim Jarvis, who was part of it, joins us here in a moment, but the life of Ann Harper, the wife of the late, great Bill Harper and the basketball secretary for so many years, for Ralph and Jimmy and Eddie. And Jim Jarvis, who I'm sure knows Ann, who turns 95, knows her well. And Bill, Roseburg High School connection. Jim Jarvis, kind enough to join us to reflect on a lot of things here today. Jim, it's great to talk to you again, sir. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Jim. To come back with, and I'm not sure how many of your former teammates will be there. I believe Mel's coming. There may be some others. But when you think back to a 63-64 team that goes to the Final Four and your role in it, what are some of the first things, Jim, that come to mind about that year, that team, the 62-63 team?
Well, it was a great bunch of guys, number one. Of course, Mel Counts being an Oregon guy, we were mostly Oregon guys. Mel, myself, and Terry Baker, and Steve Pauley, and Rex Benner, and Lynn Baxter, and I could go on and on, I think, about Oregon kids and great athletes. Nobody needs to say any more about Terry Baker than what has been said. He's one of the great athletes of all time in the state of Oregon, being a Heisman Trophy winner. And of course, that particular year, we couldn't use Terry until after the Liberty Bowl because he was out for football, so he didn't have a full season there. And then Steve Pauley, I think I'm correct. I know his freshman year, he didn't even play real basketball. He was playing town ball and training for the AAU decathlon, which he won. He's not just a great basketball player, he's just a great athlete. And then, of course, there was Peters and myself and some of others, and it was a great year.
Jim, we just read a story sent to us by Mike Stevenson yesterday about the year before, 61-62, which you wouldn't have been eligible to play on that team, but the article by Sports Illustrated, came out and spent some time with Slats and that team that year and marveled over Terry Baker's passing ability. Now, we knew he could throw it in football, but what can you tell us about Terry, a basketball player, as a passer and player overall?
Well, Terry was just a born leader. You know, everybody looked up to Terry, and he was not a selfish player. He was a team player. He was, he was left-handed, but he could go either way. He wasn't exceptionally quick, but he was very strong, and he could get a step on a guy and hold him off and make a play either to score or get the ball to somebody else. He was just a and a good guy.
Jim Jarvis joining us. Jim, there's so many things about the arc of your career, and we'll try to touch on some of them. But sticking for a moment with the 62-63 season, Roberto was telling me, and I don't know if this came from you or somebody else, just as we were all iced in and snowed in the other day here, had a hard time, kind of a four-day freeze and couldn't get out of town. Was the 62-63 season the year where a plane had to be to get the starters up to a game in Pullman and everybody else drove their own cars? Did that happen that year?
No, actually, it happened my senior year.
Okay, well, tell us that story, if you would. What happened?
Well, we had a Friday night game in Seattle against the Huskies. We had a 1 o'clock TV game in Pullman on Saturday. So we were scheduled to fly out Saturday morning from Seattle to Pullman. We get up Saturday morning, and Seattle is totally fogged in, no flights going out. So we rented cars. And we were going over some Kwame Pass at 100 miles an hour. And we got above the fog, and it was a perfect blue sky, but the highway was packed with snow, and snow on the, had been plowed 4 or 5 feet high on each side of the highway. And we get pulled over by the state police, and they had cleared a small airport up there for us, and they flown in two private planes to pick up the starting five, and Coach Valenti and Bill Robertson, our trainer, and fly us to Pullman. And the rest of the team came in at halftime.
Oh, my gosh. You don't hear about stories like that nowadays.
Needless to say, we didn't win.
Oh, no.
So the five of you, five starters, you played the whole first half and then had a little reinforcement in the second. Is that true?
That's right.
Oh,
that's
my goodness. Right.
That's
I see that happening now with this Oregon and Washington being in the Big Ten.
Yeah.
How many plane flights and airports have been closed in the last month in the Midwest?
That's a great point. That's a whole different story altogether.
Yeah.
Jim Jarvis, our guest from the Final Four team of 1963. Johnny?
So, Jim, you get drafted. You play some pro ball in the ABA, but you also go on to coaching. We can get into a few details, but which one did you like when it was all said and done? Where did you have the most satisfaction or fun, coaching or playing?
Well, basketball was probably – I love both basketball and baseball. It was actually why I was here. I played more baseball than basketball because as soon as basketball season was over, the next day I was on the baseball field. And then in the summer, I'd go back into the Basin League, which at that time is what the East Coast League is, not the Basin League, but the one everybody scouts send everybody to.
Oh, Cape Cod?
I went to Watertown, South Dakota one summer, and then Valentine, Nebraska the next summer. And Frank Peters was at Valentine, Nebraska with me, playing baseball there all summer. So then I'd get back to school, and then right away I was picking up a basketball. So there was an interesting time, and I can remember coming back from my senior year that Coach Lundy called me in the office and said, "Jim, he says, here's our situation. You know, Mel's gone. We're going to be playing with a 6'6" walk-on center by the name of Ed Fredenberg from Marshfield, and he said, you're going to have to take 20 shots a game for us to win. Do you think you can do that?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but I'll try." But Ed Fredenberg turned out, as you know, to be a great player for Oregon State. And the last 5 minutes of the half and the last 5 minutes of the game, it was basically Ed Fredenberg and I for Fredenberg screening for me at the top of the key. And then I'd make a move, and either if they double key me, I could sit behind my back to him, and he's a good enough shooter that he can hit that pretty consistently. And that was a fun year, but you know, it wasn't as fun as playing in the national championship game or the following year. I don't know if you really looked at those schedules, but I pulled them up online today, and the schedules that we played then were, we were independents at that time until my senior year. And it was a national schedule. I mean, we didn't play any Patsies. Everybody was a name team. Indiana, Kentucky, played in the Kentucky Invitational. That was an interesting thing too, Mike. We go back to playing in Kentucky at Rupp Arena. and there's West Virginia, Kentucky, Oregon State, and Iowa in the tournament. There was only one black player in those four teams. And the first night, the game between Kentucky and Iowa, somebody in the stands threw firecrackers at the black kid.
Oh, man.
You know, and it's a shock to all of us. And, of course, the transition of the black athlete into the sport had not, it was just on the front edge.
That's quite a story in itself, Jim. We appreciate you taking time to reflect on that a little bit. What do you remember about the Final Four is such a gigantic event now and has been for a lot of years. How was it then? You guys had to win three games to get there, you and the 21 team, the only team in the history of NCAA of Beaver basketball to win three games in the tournament. What do you remember about the run to the Final Four that year?
Well, it was, what I remember the most about it, we were certainly not favored in the regional tournament, but we ended up beating San Francisco the first game, and then that we had to play Arizona State, and they had Jumpin' Joe Caldwell, mm-hmm. who was an All-American. And nobody gave us a chance to win that game. But Steve Pauley absolutely shut Caldwell down. And we win that game and win it fairly easily. And then we go to the Final Four, and then that was a whole another level. And in that, we played in Freedom Hall, seated 20,000 people, and that time they let people smoke in the arena. So there was a cloud of smoke hanging on the ceiling. But I can remember the start of that game, and I was always coming off the bench as a starter, and Terry apparently was not feeling well, and early in the game, the guard for Cincinnati had stolen the ball from him three times, almost in a row, made the lay-ins and missed one, and then I remember Slots turning to me and saying, "Jim, you go bring it down." I'm thinking, mm-hmm. "Here's my hero just got humbled in front of the world, and you want me to go do that?" But I was able to do the job. But we got beat handily that night, and then you had to play a consolation game,
right?
And we got hammered then by Duke too. We actually had, I think, a better team the next year. We played the same type of schedule, if not harder. But we only lost four games all year long.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know that, and then Slats goes out on that note on a 25 win team, 25-4, I think, his final season, and he called it a career. Were you expecting that? I mean, or did it take you by surprise that Slats retired as head basketball coach after that season?
Well, when you're playing, you don't think anything, but I can hardly wait to get back and play the next year. It never entered my mind that Slats would retire, but I can see why. You know, he had pretty good players that were even, and particularly number one in Mel Cal.
Yeah. What was Slats like to play for, Jim?
He was a taskmaster. You know, he was my freshman, my sophomore year. Well, my sophomore year, I was struggling with my shot. And part of the reason was at that time, just prior to that, was when they had the great two-hand set shooters. So Flat decided that I should be a two-hand set shooter. So I said, "Flat, my dad is a great two-hand set shooter, and I can do that. But when I do that, then my one-hand shot goes awry." And he said, "Well, we'll just watch your release on your right hand and see if you get the same release on your left hand." And so I got pretty good. I could step almost back to the center line and hit a two-hand set shot. And our first game, of course, Terry wasn't back, was against Seattle View in Seattle. And they had Eddie Miles playing for them. And so I'm in warm-ups, and I start from the top of the key shooting two-hand set shots. And I make it, and I take a step back, and I'm almost to the center line, switching every one of them. So the game goes on. Well, that's how many of those I made in the game. 0-for-11. That was the end of that.
Yeah.
That was the end of that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wanted to, I used to hang a little bit with my jump shot, so he wanted me to get it off quicker. And he actually invented and built a hopper in the side basket that was had a made out of aluminum rod that shaped this big hopper that had canvas on it that would go way up above the side and out far enough away and high enough that if you missed the shot, the ball wouldn't bounce out. It would go in the hopper, and it came on the railing back out, and it'd be maybe 20 balls on that railing. And so I'd come out every night before practice and probably shoot 200 or 300 shots where I just grab a ball in rhythm and shoot it and grab a ball in rhythm and shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I changed my shot and got confidence in it eventually.
And you say Slats invented that thing.
Yeah. Nobody else. I've never seen one since.
Yeah. What you describe, I'm not sure I've seen, so that's interesting. And that's what I was told, Mel has told me before, and others in other conversations, that Slats had a very sharp mind, analytical mind, and used it. Would you concur?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Doug Peters and I were good friends, and oftentimes on a road trip, we might have breakfast together, and Frank and I'd be sitting by ourselves at the table, and the other guys would be scattered around. We were down at, we'd beaten Stanford on Friday night, and at that time, we'd never gone down and beat Stanford and Cal back-to-back. And so we're having our breakfast, and Frank and I are sitting together, and all of a sudden, here comes Slats to our table, and he was great about baiting it, you know, and he said, well, what did you guys have anything that we could do differently tonight? And so Frank, being Frank, started making suggestions, which is absolutely the worst thing that could have ever happened. And so we have a team meeting later that morning, and the topic was that he has two prima donnas that think he knows how to coach the basketball team. I could have killed Frank.
So he didn't mean it. When he asked you, hey, any ideas for tonight's game, he just was, he didn't expect you to answer him, huh?
That's funny.
Well, he wanted to know what your thoughts were.
Right.
It better be his line of thinking.
Right. Hey, you mentioned Frank Peters. I've only known Frank sort of in his entrepreneurial days later with an establishment in Portland on the east side. I'd talked to him there, interacted with him there, enjoyed the heck out of him. He's told me some minor league baseball stories and so on. What was he, based on what you just said, I think I have a sense of it, but what was he like as a teammate? Have you stayed in touch with Frank through the years?
Frank and I have stayed really good friends. In fact, when Frank had his issue and was serving some time, I actually went in there and watched the game. He called me and said there was a kid in prison there that he thought had a chance to be a player. He was a 6'4 black kid out of Portland. So I went in there and watched him, and I made phone calls to him almost once a month while he was in there. He and I remained very good friends. Sometime I can tell you some really good stories if you want to buy me a beer. not on the radio.
Well, I'd love
you
to hear those.
Yeah.
A quick thought on playing with Connie Hawkins in the ABA.
That was a great thrill. I mean, here's a guy that really, even by the time he was there, you know, he was not able to play in the NBA because of a supposed scandal when he was in Iowa as a freshman. Anyway, so he played with the Globetrotters and gone around the world. And still, he had a knee that would go out on him every once in a while. But boy, I tell you, as a guard, was he fun to play with. He had such big hands, you could throw it anywhere near him. And when I was in the game, I'd throw it to him and cut to the basket, and he'd fake the pass. And I'd do that two or three times. And the fourth time, he'd give me a lay-in. Mm. So he liked me to be in the game. But he was... And he was a good guy, and I really respected him here. You know, Connie passed away, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he had retired. You know, he eventually got in the NBA, and he retired in Scottsdale area. And I was selling real estate at the time in Bend, and I came back in the office one day, and there was a message from Connie Hawkins. Now, I only played with him that one year, and then I got traded to L.A. Stars. And it was a message from Connie Hawkins, and so I played phone tag with him for a week or so, and I finally got a hold of him. I basically said, Connie, you know, why are you calling me? And he said, Jimmy, he said, I ran into a couple from Oregon at the airport, and I asked them if they knew you, and they said they didn't know you, but they knew who you were. And they got back to me and told me how to get a hold of you, and he said, I'm just calling to see how you're doing. And to tell you, I really respected you as a player and as a person.
That's a great deal, Jim. And you shared that story years ago, and we talked about all of it. I just find that a fascinating bookend to your one and only season as a Pittsburgh Piper with the legendary Connie Hawkins, but that you guys had that on-court relationship, and he liked you and admired you and reached out to you many, many years later. I'm glad he did. I'm glad that meant a lot to you. Jim will be in town with a lot of Oregon State basketball legends this weekend. Final thing, and that, Jim, is about the Harper family and Bill and Ann, and Ann will be recognized this weekend, too. What did Bill and Ann and that family mean to you?
Well, let me start off with Ann. My little wife is right here, and when my dad got the job at Roseburg, Bill had given up the basketball job just to do the baseball. So they hired my dad as a basketball coach at Roseburg, and at that time we had been at Coquille, and Dad and Mom stayed in Coquille this summer while Dad worked with the Forest Service for the summer job. And so I went over and spent the first couple of nights at Bill and Ann's house. And while I was there, Ann said, you got to meet this little babysitter of ours, and we call her Gabby. Well, that's my wife. That's my wife today.
Oh, wow.
Lynn Forrest, yeah. And then Bill, of course, he was really fun to play for. He was a taskmaster, too. Mm-hmm. You know, he came to the class program, but he kidded me that I got him kicked out of more baseball games than any other player he'd ever coached.
Well, hey, these are all great stories. Now, I got to close with my own taskmaster because I played for him, and this guy you knew, and Tom Phipps was a taskmaster. All of you, a long line of great taskmasters. As a high school coach, Jim, he was pretty tough on us in Cottage Grove. What do you remember about Tom?
Well, of course, he came up and worked for me at the University of Idaho for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left. But he was, you know, Tom was not the most talented basketball player, but he was a hard-nosed, gritty, in-your-face type of defender and a good guy.
Yes. Yeah. And I see Tom, or I'm going to see him when the Beavers go down to play in the Valley later this year. Love him and love that whole connection. He speaks so fondly of you and of Bill and of so many in his life experiences, Coach Valenti, Jimmy, Ralph. I close with this only because I love to hear this story. Scouting reports. Please tell us that one again one more time. When you were given a scouting report and you prepared for hours and hours and hours to present it at practice, tell us that story again, if you would, please.
Ring my bell a little bit on that. I can't remember what that was.
Ralph didn't care as much about what the other guy was doing, and you prepared for hours a report on somebody or something like that.
I can't remember who I'd gone to scout, but I'd taken down every detail I could take down, you know, whether you need to play a guy in his right hand or whatever it might be, a lot of detail. And so we go to I bring it back, and the next week of practice, we practice Monday night, and he doesn't say anything about it, and Tuesday night doesn't say anything about it, and it gets to just before the game time, and he's talking to the team, and he turns around to the blackboard. At that time, we didn't have the fancy dressing rooms they have now, and he said, oh, by the way, you might watch for a couple of these things, and that was my scouting report.
You said the first time you told me, oh, Jarvis, you got something on these guys. Well, don't worry about it. Just go play your game or whatever. It made me laugh. But Ralph had a system. Jim, it's great talking to you again. We look forward to seeing you this weekend at Gill Coliseum. Thanks for making time for us.
Good. Thanks, Mike.
The great Jim Jarvis, our guest. We'll take a final break and wrap things up for the day. The smoke at the Final Four, hovering in the building. The sad story he told about going down for that Kentucky Invitational. But that was the beginnings of the great change that needed to take place and did in Glory Road. The Beavers were one win away from playing Don Haskins UTEP team in that 65-66 season. Utah beat the Beavers 70-64 in the Elite Eight. Had the Beavers broken through and won that, they might have prevented Glory Road from happening.
Yeah.
Anyway, we break and come back. Wrap up today's show next on the Joe Beaver Show.
Look at that. I was reading a text and didn't see a PSA.
Right. Oh, I heard a PSA, but you get a couple of texts in. Dave from Sandy, thank you. A recollection on listening to Harry Carey calling Cardinals games.
This one by Dan is really good. Great interview with Jim Jarvis. Love the past players from the 60s and their recollections of great Beaver experiences. My dad turned out for basketball and worked out with Red Rocha, Lou Beck, maybe Bill Harper, just after World War II. Didn't make the team, just one of the guys that practiced. Dad said Paul Valenti helped Slats and would scrimmage and get his nose hit a lot. Good get, guys. Thanks, Dan. That's great. Yeah, that's... isn't that fun when you... You know, it's so funny, too, because a lot of times parents don't tell the stories. They just don't tell you that unless you ask. It just depends on who they are. But, you know, I found out things that are like, you might have wanted to lead with that kind of a thing with my parents on some famous
things. Now, what was the thing about, what was your connection to Mel Blanc?
My grandfather and he were friends. Mel Blanc went to Lincoln High School and was in the music industry, the big band music industry, as my mom's dad and, well, my grandparents were, both the grandma and grandpa. And so they were friends because Mel Blanc was in the music business, and he would come over, and they would know. And then he went to L.A. and made it big with the voiceover stuff.
But they were willing to, I mean, you knew about that growing up.
Yeah, that was an early story.
It wasn't like a cartoon, oh, Mel Blanc's so funny.
No, but there was a late
and...
story. My mom says that her parents would take turns going to play, you know, because that's how they made their money on Saturday nights, and then whoever's turn it was, and she was waiting in one of the green rooms just as a little girl, and Bing Crosby comes in, well, hello, little girl, yeah. Anyway, just straight. I'm like, Mom, you might want to lead with that. See you tomorrow.